go forward with it, someone might die.
Yeah, there's no point. Oh, I got a question for
there's
you.
There's no salvaging it at this point. Okay, what's up?
Are you a alcohol in the mouthwash person or a no alcohol mouthwash person? Take your time.
I prefer to drink my alcohol separately.
I see. That surprises me.
Well, I don't really pay attention. If I'm buying mouthwash, I'm not really paying attention if it has alcohol or not.
Okay.
I don't guess. I was by the Act brand.
Yeah.
Somebody told me a long time ago that that's the good one, and I just never questioned it.
Yeah. Go with what you know. In Texas, the store, the major store that everyone loves, that's like a local store, is HEB.
Okay.
And they have a store brand that's pretty on point. So that's what I use. And I choose the...
They put liquor in it?
Yeah. I mean, it says Jimmy Dean on it, but it's a store... It's a store brand.
Jimmy Dean selects the sausage.
Or not Jimmy Dean. What was I thinking?
You mean Jim Beam.
Jim Beam. Jimmy Dean. Jimmy Dean's sausage mouthwash.
It's my mouthwash. Jim Beam. That's... You don't have to spit it out is the good thing about it.
Yeah, dude. It's like, you don't want to waste time. Where you can put in your mouth and spit it out. Yeah. Genius.
You know, swish it around, swallow. Just get on with your day.
I like the purple one too. That's the one I get.
Okay. I don't regularly do mouthwash. It's not like part of the usual routine.
Yeah, hey.
It's just kind of like sometimes.
I'm not sitting here trying to pretend like I'm Mr. Oral Hygiene, but
I Mr. do. Oral something.
Yeah.
Hello. Yellow.
You're listening to Fun Club.
Welcome to Fun Club episode number 5. I'm Kat. Joining me, of course, is Crow. How's it going, dude?
Really, really good.
Awesome. Really good. Glad to hear it. I'm also... Not that you asked, but I'm also doing pretty good.
It's good to hear. So,
you know.
It's really good
to
hear.
You're not the only one.
Really good to hear. I'd prefer that's the way you are for podcasts.
Yeah, you know, you don't want me to be all mopey and, you know, weird and stuff. So anyway, we are here today to discuss a film called Akira. But before we get into it, I kind of want to do a little bit of a preface here. We're trying a different approach. You know, this is only our 5th episode. We're still... early in the early development stages of getting this podcast going, and we're still trying different things and figuring out the format that works for us. And you know, so far we've been doing this thing where we're kind of going play by play, right? Kind of retelling the story of the movie or the show or whatever that we've watched, which is a fun way to do it. You know, we were talking like, you know, we've been saying this is like a book club, right? It's like we all watch the thing or read the thing or whatever, and then we come talk about it. And I mean, I used to be in a book club and we didn't just sit down and recount the story beginning to end, you know, scene by scene by scene. We all read the book. We all know what happens, you know, and we're just here to talk about the stuff that we liked about it. So we're going to try that as the approach this time. Makes it a little easier on us, for one. And I think it'll just be a little more fun way to have a conversation. So, yeah, we're assuming anyone listening to this has watched it, but even if you haven't, I don't know. You might glean something of value from it. I will say, if you have not watched the movie Akira, the 1998 or 1988 anime, you know, classic, boy, oh boy, you really need to watch this. And I waited way too long. I didn't watch it until, you know, we watched it for this podcast. And man, oh man, oh man, it's a heck of a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I don't know. I guess it's a kind of a unique perspective wherever you are, whatever, wherever it is in the timeline that you watch it. But because it's funny, it's set in the far future of 2019, I think. But it would have been pretty funny yeah. to watch it in 2019. But
yeah,
as time, well, not to jump straight into it, but one thing that really stood out to me, even though it is so old. Like how well done the animation is, it makes you,
oh, yeah.
If you didn't know it was made in the 80s, you wouldn't be able to ascertain that by the animation. Like some things you can tell it was animated you know, a while back.
Yeah.
This one still trumps a lot of the current animation, like, by a pretty wide margin.
Yeah, and what was the animation technology in 1988? I mean, I don't think a lot of computers were involved. I think it was still just human beings with, you know, pens in their hands drawing most of these scenes, if not all of them.
Oh, you can tell they did some sort of cell layering because they had so many, like, multi-focus points and, like, you know, what's it called? The blur of something in the background, almost like a lens would be in a movie. And that,
a bloom.
Yeah. Bokeh or something, however they call it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's clearly leagues above other animations.
The phenomenal animation, even if it were something that were released today, it would blow your mind, you know, and then you remind yourself it was made in 1988 and it's just incredible. So yeah, 1988, the writers are, sorry if I butcher the pronunciations, Katsuhiro Otomo and Izo Hashimoto are the writers. The director is Katsuhiro Otomo, one of the writers. Being from another country, I'm not really familiar with those people and what other works they've done. I think there's one other thing that I wanted to mention before we really get into the meat of the discussion. I was talking about how we're doing a new approach to this thing. I also just kind of wanted to give people, set expectations about how we're approaching these discussions and stuff like that. I don't want people to get the idea that we're trying to present ourselves as, like, you know, experts or, like, professional movie critics or, like, you know, we don't know everything there is to know about these things. This is like, you know, we're like college roommates and we saw a cool movie and we're talking about it. You know, that's the approach. So there's very likely all kinds of deep meaning that's going completely over our heads and stuff like that. Funclubpod@gmail.com. Enlighten us, you know.
Absolutely.
But I just kind of wanted to set that as an expectation. It's a very casual approach to these conversations.
Yeah. By no means are we experts on virtually anything, but fans would be the description.
Yeah. We're kind of just fans of these things. And if we're doing all this, like, deep research and, like, trying to tie all these connections, I feel like we kind of lose the fun. We lose the magic at a certain point. You know, we saw a cool thing and we're going to talk about what's cool about it. And, you know, that's that. So anyway, just general open discussion here. What a wild ride this movie is. It's 2 hours long. I'm pretty impatient with movie. Like if a movie is over like an hour and 20 minutes, man, I'm like, okay, you need to be justifying every scene from this point forward, because this is my time we're cutting into here. Man, I never for a moment, like, was checking the time or checking to see how much time the movie had left. I was like, I was into it, like, wanting to know the next thing that happened, you know, one moment to the next, all the way to the end.
I already knew that I didn't know much about it, but I was surprised that even my preconceived notions of what it was about, I literally thought it was about the dude with the cool motorcycle whose name is Akira.
Yep. I thought the dude on the motorcycle's name was Akira for sure. And I thought it was mostly going to be about motorcycle stuff, which it really isn't at all. It's funny that that's like such an iconic thing of the movie. And it's really just kind of the opening sequence. And it's hardly even really referred to again after that.
Yeah. it was surprised at how iconic just the, most of the, I'm sure there's multiple different covers all over the place, but the cover that you usually see, which is the bike, which has become synonymous with, like, the image of Akira. That's what you think of when you think of Akira, is the bike and, you know, who I now know is Kaneda.
Kaneda,
yeah. However you say his name. And
I guess it depends on which version you watched and how they pronounced it.
Oh, did they say Kaneda in yours?
In mine, they said they pronounced it Kaneda.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, they said Kaneda in mine.
Okay.
Interesting. See, there we go. We just found a cool fact.
Different dubs. Oh, I guess that's a thing. We are anime noobs, and we watched it in dub, not in the original Japanese.
Yeah, we're dub. Should say that. Dub schlubs.
We're not elitists.
Not at all. The bike. I after I watched that, I went back to see just thumbed through the graphic novel that I have that I'd never read. Like I said, in the last episode, I just kind of randomly picked it up because it was like $2 and I just couldn't pass it up, but I hadn't read it. And I went back and kind of thumbed through it. Totally different, dude. Like even in the beginning when they are chasing down the clown gang and all that, like that doesn't even happen in the graphic novel. They're just riding their bikes, having fun, racing each other to go get a bite to eat and stumble across that big, where the bomb landed.
I wonder if that graphic novel was made to be a bit more like family friendly or something like that, because man, it's a brutal.
Yeah.
there's a brutality. Like there are these rivaling biker gangs, but I mean, the word rival doesn't even really, I mean, these guys are straight up murdering each other on sight, you know?
Yeah.
And the movie doesn't hold back on the violence and the brutality. And, it's hard to watch at times.
Yeah. It took me by a surprise. I didn't realize it's just another element of the movie as a whole that I was not expecting at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't either. And it's, you know, the movie opens up and it's like, there's these young fun loving teenagers and they're like in this biker gang and I don't know. It's kind of like this sort of fun energy happening. And then you just see a dude get his skull cracked open, you know, and you're like, whoa, like just a weird, crazy, you know, we're watching a cartoon here. So it just feels like, you know, we're just having a fun time. And then it gets real quick.
I thought they did a pretty good job of the way the kids act. Like even though it is it's very, you know, brutal and, you know, violent, but they did a good job of how people who were raised around that would act. I mean, they're seeing people getting gutted, murdered, skull stomped in, all this stuff, and they're just like, let's get out of here. You know, that doesn't even affect them like hardly at all, just because that's the world they live in, you know?
There's multiple examples of that. There's one particular one I'll point out later, but yeah, they're just completely desensitized to all sorts of awful stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, that kind of thing is real, like in a lot of places in the world that are used to that hyperviolence. I'm glad they had that element in there. It made it a little bit more, I don't know if believable is the word, but it made it a little bit more fitting, I guess is the better word.
I love the pacing though. It was like my favorite thing about the movie. I wish every movie was this way from like just the jump, like first scene, we're like, whoa, we're on a ride here, you know, and just all the way to the end. It just never stops. I love that, man. I wish more movies. There's so many movies where I'm like checking the time, like, okay, this scene is not necessary. This is not, you know, there's no character development happening. This isn't really advancing the plot. You're wasting my time. This is a 3-hour movie and we have an unnecessary scene here. You know, I can't stand that stuff. None of that here, man. It's all thriller, no filler, beginning to end.
For a movie that's, I would say, high concept, I mean, it's really hard to make that work without that, because they get into a lot of stuff that would be, you know, easily lost on a lot of viewers. So the second you make it too boring to tap out on, it's, you know, you've lost a lot of people, and especially movies that deep, I don't know if deep meaning, but deep intricate plot points that kind of keep evolving.
Oh yeah. It really lends itself to multiple viewings too, because you're totally right. There's lots of kind of like, you know, there's multiple layers of meaning and stuff to dig into, but even if that stuff's completely lost on you, you know, and you're just here for a good time, like that's fine. You're going to have a good time and you don't even have to pay attention to the details. Just the pretty pictures and stuff is enough to justify the time you spend on it, you know? So yeah, let's just get into a little bit of talking about the art and visual. I mean, we've already talked a lot about that, but let's just kind of focus on that for a minute here. The art and visual style, it's like an 80s retro futurist, I guess, cyberpunk. I've seen people describe it as cyberpunk, but it does not have a super futuristic vibe to it. You know, it's very industrial and it's not like, you know, things are not shiny here. There's not a big lot, like big flashing lights. It's grimy. Like this world is falling apart. You know, it's not like this digital metropolis or anything like that.
Yeah. I think a lot of the cyberpunk elements just is a byproduct of the fact that it came out in the same decade as Blade Runner. So that kind of future scape of post-apocalyptic style, when someone's making that type of movie where it's either retro, future, whatever the case may be, if it came out after Blade Runner, it's almost impossible not to have been either influenced or compared to that movie. And this one was only, I mean, this one came out in 88, Blade Runner came out in 82. So that's not even that far away. So, I don't think there was any getting away from that comparison to that style.
Yeah.
I don't think it was anywhere close to cyberpunk. Yeah, like I agree with you. I don't think it was more, I don't know, industrial punk. Kind of like you said, it was more industrial. It was like future.
Yeah, maybe that's a better term for it. Industrial punk, kind of. Yeah, because like I think of cyberpunk, I'm thinking of like people are like putting robot parts in their body and stuff like that. You know, there's none of that really happening here.
Yeah, and I mean, there definitely was like heightened advanced technology, but it wasn't like everyone wasn't walking around with, you know, Android assistants and flying cars and like all this stuff. And there was technology that was massively leaps ahead of what, you know, anything else in the movie you could see, you know, like when it gets later on into the movie where they're, you know, dealing with the, I don't know how far we want to jump the gun, but when they're dealing with the kids, like they had all kinds of, in Akira itself, like all kinds of crazy technology, but that wasn't part of the element of the setting of the world.
Yeah, it's not like the technology is not like ubiquitous to the general population. It's like the government has access to it and really just very limited. You know, it's like, yeah, we have the resources to do this in this one instance because we really have to, you know.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's not like just the whole world's overrun with like crazy advanced technology. Really, it kind of seems technologically stunted compared to like the actual world we're living in right now in 2024.
Yeah, that's true.
As far as like what the average citizen has in their daily lives, you know.
That's true, especially for being written in the 80s. And, you know, you see those articles. It's funny to go back and see, you know, Scientific American article from the 60s where it's like, what the world to be like in 2020? And you see all these like crazy technology, you know, everything's like Jetsons looking or whatever. Like, it's very interesting. I don't know if they did it on purpose. But
I think so, yeah. Because we'll get into the story and the plot and stuff. But basically, like in the you know, it was made in 1988, but also in the story in 1988, there was a giant catastrophe that caused World War III. And so I think just the technological advancement of the world maybe just sort of stopped while that was going on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can't. You know? It's hard to advance when you're blown to freaking smithereens. So
yeah, and just all your like nation's resources are being dumped into this war rather than, you know, I'm sure like technology was invented for those purposes, but
yeah, exactly. I mean, even in like the real world after World War II, I mean, we were freaking tapped, you know.
But yeah, there's a real brutality to the art and visual and stuff. There's a brutality to it. It's very metal. There's a lot of gore. Like it's just people just straight up getting, you know, disemboweled and crap like that. Like I said, hard to watch at times. The streaking taillights thing, I'm sure that's something that a lot of people remember from the movie or have seen from the movie.
Heck yeah.
That's really just in that opening sequence with the motorcycle gangs chasing each other around and stuff. But man, so cool looking. Just all the taillights streaking around while they're zipping and zapping around.
Really cool. And I really liked the...
Super cool.
It seemed like they really animated it to match filmography. Like it was made with intent adults, not for kids, like obviously with all the, you know, violence and stuff, but it matched filmmaking, even like the streaking lights. I mean, back in the day, cameras had a hard time with lights, you know, and you'd see, especially if you go look back at old concerts, like Queen concerts and things like that, and they're moving the camera around, the lights are like streaking everywhere. And it was kind of like stylized like that, but even their use of depth in the animation, kind of like what I was talking about earlier with the like multiple points of focus and coming in and out of focus and animating something where you're going around it and having that perspective continue to be accurate. If you're drawing that is like God tier level animation.
Oh, dude, the the amazing, yeah, like perspectives, like during these chase sequences where, yeah, they're like zipping around the corner of a building and you're just changing these perspectives so fast. And it's all just so, you know, you're immersed in it completely.
Yeah, man. And also the music, the score of the movie, I thought it was really interesting. I'm sure someone else has done this, but I noticed it and I can't really think off the top of my head someone else that's done this outside of like maybe Stanley Kubrick, but the use of silence was really well placed and well done. And not a lot of people use silence, but that was an integral part of the audio of the movie.
I love that. I love it when movies do that, and it works real well for this movie. And that's something that I noted too. Like the music is good, but it's really, there's really not a ton of it. And when there is music, it's really just kind of setting a tone. It's not really drawing a ton of attention to itself, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the sound design is good and stuff like that, but music doesn't seem to be a really important element, honestly, to me.
It's almost more like just a soundscape.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's just a soundscape for the, for what's going on rather than an accompaniment.
Yeah, just kind of like a, it's like a cue to tell me like, okay, it's action time. This is an action sequence.
Yeah.
Or oh, this is scary. It's scary time now, you know, it kind of just serves that function.
Yeah.
Just a little bit more about art and visual stuff. I noticed anytime there's any kind of like smoke or fog or anything like that, that's just super cool. Like really well animated, very billowy and pillowy. Like I want to give a cloud a hug or something. Really, like it had this like thick syrupy kind of texture to it. Also, like any fabric, like blankets, or like when someone sits, like sinks into a couch, did you notice like how the fabric kind of moves around them?
Yeah,
like, so cool looking.
Yeah, you just don't get that kind of attention to animation anymore. I'm not saying that no modern animation is good, obviously that's not true, but there was so much like love poured into the animation of this. It's so noticeable.
Oh,
and I
no.
think it actually, I think it benefits from not having like crazy high resolution. I went back and watched a couple clips. I just was in my head and just kind of going back and watching things on YouTube, and almost all of them, it was like super 4K. And man, it lost a lot, honestly. Like it, in like these restoration versions of, because the one I watched, I mean, it couldn't have been more than 720. I mean even at the time they just didn't have that high resolution of stuff, but it really benefited from that because it was, everything was organically as intended, and the mastery of the animation was so noticeable.
Yeah,
again, I'm not an expert in anything anime at all, but I'll be interested to see. I know the Otomo or Otomo guy, but I'd be interested to see like what all came out of that animation house, like where that was put together, to go watch other stuff that was made like that. So it was just on such another level, man.
Oh yeah. And so, yeah, like you said, just so much love put into it. Like just like the fabric I was talking about, like there's this scene, this dude just like sits on a chair, and you know, it had to have taken a lot of work to make the fabric look the way it did. It looked just right too. Like it wasn't like overly animated, you know, it wasn't really drawing your attention to it or anything. It just looks the way fabric looks when you move around and stuff. Had nothing to do with what was going on in the scene or whatever, but it was awesome. Just added a ton to it. I certainly appreciated it.
I'm glad it got made when it got made, because I think that it really benefited from being made in a time where the focus of making a film was to make it as awesome as possible. And I think now like modern movies lose a lot because of how things are now, with like just content has to be pumped out so much quicker in order for people to make money and all this, for that machine to keep rolling.
Or it's focus tested to death to have like mass appeal.
Yeah.
And so it loses like this specialness that it would have had.
Yeah. And almost the overwhelming majority of especially animation outside of, you know, there is good animation. Like there, you know, Disney obviously is good at animating. Like Pixar is good animation. But this one, I think, benefited from the time it was made in, because I don't think you would be able to pour that much into it if it was made now. And I certainly hope, really hope, that they don't remake this movie at least for another like 15 years or something, until we're a little bit farther removed from an industry that just loves to ruin movies and remake everything.
I feel like people say this about every beloved piece of film or whatever, but they should never remake this movie. It is perfect as it is. Just leave it alone, people.
Leave it alone. I mean, would I see it? 1,000%. Like, and now
I'll watch
part
it.
Of the problem because I would see it. But
a live action adaptation, dude, I would watch
that'd
it.
That'd be insane. Sure. And I've heard them. There's been rumblings.
Do I think
they
should make it? No, but I would watch it.
Absolutely not. But they've been talking about making it forever. I mean, Keanu Reeves was attached to it for a long time, and all. I mean, they've gone as far as almost going into production so many times, and I could be talking about this now, and they're actually in production. I don't know, but I hope they don't, man. I hope they don't. There's some things that just need to live as they are forever.
I agree. If the Cowboy Bebop live action series taught us anything, it's that.
Yeah, there's too much. Movies, especially remakes, are victim to too many things now. Too many. I mean, corporate control, politics, like all this stuff is just a witch's brew of things that ruin things. So there's so many
cooks in the kitchen. There's so many cooks in the kitchen and so many vested interests that a lot of time what comes out the other end is not what the people intended from the beginning.
It's a shame, really. But
another thing I want to mention really quick about this, it being anime, I feel like specifically when talking about anime, it's something worth mentioning is that female characters are very well represented. Just, you know, when we're talking about anime, a lot of times that's just not the case. You know, it's just for better or for worse, that's the case. You know, a lot of time the female characters are just kind of just stupid sex dolls. You know what I mean? Like they don't really have a personality. They just kind of make little squealy noises and they're dressed up in little skimpy outfits and that's all they are. You know, it's a real problem in a lot of anime. This isn't like that at all. In fact, the most prominent female character, you would probably assume they were a dude, actually, if everyone didn't keep referring to her as her the whole time. You know, their sexuality isn't something that's really emphasized a lot. They're just normal people just trying to get through this situation like everybody else. I appreciated that about it as well.
Speaking of hyper versions of gender, I watched Baki.
Oh, that's a weird one.
Man, I mean,
I've watched some of it. I haven't watched all of it. I watched like maybe 5 episodes, but yeah, what a show.
I mean, it's not necessarily something I would just continue to grind on, but I mean, if I just want to watch like some dude stuff, I mean, that is a definite
go.
I mean, I feel like it's like I would watch it for the same reason I'd watch like a Stallone movie, you know, like an Arnold movie.
Yeah, that's a whole genre of anime. That's one of my favorite genres of anime. Basically, it's like a fighting tournament is the genre, is what I call it. Like every episode is just this dude's going to fight another dude.
Dude. It's like Street Fighter.
That's what it is.
Street Fighter, man.
Yeah, like there's literal animes where the whole show is nothing but a fighting tournament. Every episode is just, okay, now this guy and this guy is going to fight. Who's going to win?
Man, they the love show. That fighting tournament stuff. That's funny. Yeah. Like,
oh, I love it.
I guess I just didn't realize it. But
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, Street Fighter is one of my all-time favorite just things in general. I'm saying I'm unexperienced in anime, and as I'm talking, am I remembering all this anime stuff that I've watched?
Yeah. Anyway, we should get back to the topic at hand here. We already pretty much talked about the music, so I think we can just kind of move past that.
Yeah.
So let's get just a little bit into the story here. So like I said, we're not just going to go beat by beat and recount the whole story, but we'll give just like a general synopsis. So just getting into the kind of the setting of where this is all taking place. Basically, in this world, espers exist. Espers as in ESP, they have, you know, like telekinetic abilities and stuff like that. How they get them, I'm not really clear on that, but they exist. And in the year 1988, the year this thing was made, there was some giant catastrophe caused by one of these espers, whose name was Akira. And it was basically like this big, they call it a singularity, but essentially like a giant explosion that wiped the city of Tokyo off the map. Totally gone. And somehow that resulted in World War III breaking out. I don't know the details of that, but the world was enraptured with war for a long time after that. And then now, you know, at the as the movie is starting, you know, all that's in the past, and now we're in the far-flung future of 2019 in Neo Tokyo. So they've rebuilt Tokyo. They call it Neo Tokyo, and it's a total, like we were saying earlier, it's a future dystopian hellscape, right? It's barbaric, it's brutal, it's harsh. I mean, people just getting straight up stabbed in the street and people just laughing at them, you know, no one even cares. It's an awful, awful place. It seems like the government is doing experiments on these Esper people. I'm calling them Espers, by the way. The movie does not call them Espers. That's what I'm calling them because they don't really call them anything.
I was so confused for a second. I was like, dang, I missed that. Totally missed that.
No. That's just like a generic term for people who have, you know, telekinetic abilities or whatever. But yeah, they have like these superhuman abilities and the government. Did you catch this? I can't tell if they already were showing signs of these abilities and then the government goes and rounds them up and starts testing on them, or if the tests are what caused the abilities to surface.
I think they gathered them up because of their abilities.
That's what I was thinking too. That's kind of how.
Yeah, I don't know if it. Yeah, I can't remember if there was some. I have a vague memory of a flashback of some people kind of developing stuff, but yeah, they get them because of their, cause that's why they pick up old Tetsuo or whatever. Cause they.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, cause we'll get into that here in a second. But, so anyway, government is, running experiments on these people, mostly small children, it seems like. And then another feature of the world is there's these roving, rivaling biker gangs that are, you know, super barbaric and just straight up murder each other on sight, pretty much. And so that's the setup. And just getting into the plot itself here. So the story is mainly centered around two characters. We have our protagonist, a guy named Kaneda or Kaneda, depending on the the version that you watched. And he's the leader of one of these biker gangs, and they're kind of like, I don't know, I'm guessing like teenage, maybe early 20-year-old kind of people. And Kaneda, he's depicted as being a real cool guy. All the girls like him, all the guys think he's cool, you know, and he's the leader of this little gang here. And then the other character that the story focuses on is a guy named Tetsuo. And he's a friend of theirs. I guess he's part of the gang, but he kind of is like a younger brother type figure. You know, he's kind of jealous of Kaneda, but he also looks up to him. They're always kind of making fun of him and stuff. And he's, you know, they kind of pick on him a little bit, but they also let him hang around and stuff like that. So those are our two main characters. And so it turns out Tetsuo is one of these Esper people. He has these telekinetic abilities. It happened after he had a motorcycle accident and he crashed into one of these kids that escaped from the testing facility. And that's when he developed those abilities. So I don't know if it happened as a result of that accident or.
Didn't they see him on that little computer thing? They saw him like, cause they said they specifically mentioned he was like blinking blue or something instead of red, like everybody else. And they were like, oh.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff like that. But was that after he had his accident, his motorcycle accident? I wonder if him like coming in contact with that kid is what gave him the powers.
Oh, you know what? Yeah, I think they were going to get that kid, and then him crashing happened, and they saw that while they were there, just I guess, you know, on their radar of the area or
whatever. And so because one of those other Esper kids was escaping. And this dude Tetsuo just crashed into him with his motorcycle. The kid was totally unscratched, totally fine. And now Tetsuo has these abilities. So long story short, the government agent guys snatch Tetsuo up, take him to the testing facility. We see a bunch of other Esper children there as well, all kind of in a similar situation, undergoing experiments and whatnot. And over the course of time, basically Tetsuo becomes superhuman. You know, he just has, you know, he's unstoppable. He's a Super Saiyan Goku, basically. And he's an immature teen. He's probably like a 16-year-old boy, I would guess. And, you know, he has all these insecurities and all this stuff like that. And he acts the way you would expect him to. And if you're this all powerful, you're Superman all of a sudden, you know, and you're, you've been picked on your whole life and all this stuff, you know, how are you going to act? He acts, you know, how you would expect him to. He kind of goes on a little bit of a rampage, commits a little light murder, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, you know? a few killings along the path of his journey.
He just kind of loses it. And eventually it all culminates. This is the whole movie is basically him just kind of going on this rampage, and it just kind of keeps going and going until he loses control of this power. And it kind of consumes him. He turns into this giant, god-awful abomination of just, like, organs and flesh and, like, fluids.
Ew. And your description of it all, is just as gross.
Yes. Well, I'm trying to convey what I saw, okay? It was, and, you know, he loses control of it. And it's a sad thing because he's, you know, he's a kid, basically. And you kind of feel this disdain for him as he's going on this rampage, like what a jerk, what a jackass, you know. But then as he starts losing control, he becomes afraid and he starts like yelling for Kaneda, help me, you know, like he's totally turning back on his evil villain ways now that he's out of control, turning into this horrible, horrendous looking thing. I made a note here that says poor Kaori, which is his girlfriend. He like sucks her into his big globiness and she's like trying to get out. Do you remember the scene that I'm talking about where she's like stuck in there and you're like seeing her and she's like trying to get out and then she just turns into a blob of red and pink bubbles and
she just
explodes.
Crushed. Yeah.
Just gets crushed. It's so nasty.
It was pretty sad because we were all kids and
true.
The thing about being young is that you are extremely dumb. Some are dumber than others, but
super.
You don't know anything, but the things you think you know, you're very passionate about. And
yes,
for Tetsuo, who mentioned several times in the movie that he was tired of Kaneda coming to save him all the time, and he wanted to do things on his own. He was really trying to separate himself from, you know, being the Robin to the Batman and Robin, you know, he was, because they became friends long ago and kind of like stood up for him back in those flashbacks you see when he first comes to the school and he's like a dweeb and people are beating him up and stuff.
Yeah.
And, but he's really trying to set himself apart. So he's like, that's what made that scene so sad, I thought, is he's multiple times mentions that he's telling his buddy, like, dude, back off and let me, like, take care of myself. And then he's at this moment where he's just breaking and the only thing he can do is turn to his friend who has always been there for him. But now he can't do anything. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty sad.
It really is hard. He's a very, it's heartbreaking. And he's a sympathetic character the whole way. Even when he's like at the height of his jackassery, you know, it's like I feel like I was understanding the whole way, you know, not that I was excusing the behavior, but it's like, yeah, I could see how this guy would be this way.
Yeah.
You know, in this situation,
even the torment along the way of having these powers that not only can you not control, but they're basically taking you on a ride.
Yeah.
All the while, meanwhile, these other three kids, I don't even know if they have names, but 23, 25 and 26 or whatever.
Yeah,
are also, I think in the beginning, they're basically trying to kill him, like, mentally, like, get at him.
Yeah, there's like some weird hallucination stuff going on that seems like, they're either in on it. I couldn't tell if they're, like, causing it to happen or what, but there was something going on there.
Yeah, it seemed like, it seemed like they were just trying to get rid of him or something. I don't know, but maybe not the little girl, but. That scene where he's in the, when the little teddy bear and stuff crawls up on the bed, dude, that was like extraordinary. And that was probably some of the best animation in the movie, but also just like a creepy, so like cool. Eeriness.
Oh yeah. I have some notable scenes that I want to mention here in a little bit, but that's one of them. His like big hallucination, some freaking cool stuff going on there, but also disturbing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very.
So yeah, Tetsuo's losing control. He's turning into this giant blob of gross stuff. And these other kids, these other test subject kids, it's kind of weird, but it's like they're sensing that something is happening, that this is going to culminate in another kind of big event the way it did back in 1988. And I guess their plan is to bring Akira back. Akira's like broken up into like these different, they've like done so many experiments on Akira at this point that he's like, his body parts and everything are like all in these frozen jars and stuff like that. So yeah,
I forgot about that.
It's hard. It's anime. So just long story short, they bust open these jars and Akira's back magically, you know, he just is there now. And, I don't know. It's kind of like a crazy, trippy, like psychedelic sequence. It's kind of unclear exactly the sequence of events that happens, but it seems like Akira is causing this singularity thing to happen again now that he's back. And he like transports these other Esport kids and himself along with Tetsuo to like another dimension. Because I said something earlier in the movie that the kids said that, you know, surely there's a future we can choose for ourselves, you know? So I think they're trying to like cause this singularity to happen, or at least they know it's going to happen. So they're going to take advantage of it to like break themselves out of this bad situation that they're in and to be free. And so that's my understanding, is that basically they were transported to another like realm of existence where they're like these beings of pure energy now, you know?
And, yeah.
And they escaped through that whole debacle.
Yeah. That part was, I would need to rewatch, and I don't know, some of the plot lines are, I just wasn't ready mentally, but yeah. I going into this movie thinking it's going to be, you know, a cool motorcycle action movie. Like a lot of this stuff, yeah. I just was not in the right brain space, which is cool. I kind of like that. It's going to allow me to go back and rewatch, and you know, that's one of my favorite things about me. I mean, if I'm understanding a movie completely the first time I watch it, you know, I want it to be Ace Ventura. You know what I mean? Like these kind of movies. Yeah. I'm glad that it's that complex, but not just complex for the sake of being complex. Complex because it's that good. Like the actual prose of the dialogue and the story itself was put together so well. So that is cool. But yeah, some of that stuff I was like, wait, what? What is happening?
Yeah, how far into Tetsuo's grotesque transformation were you when you were asking yourself, where are all the motorcycles in this movie? So Akira, I guess, starts to bring back this singularity, this catastrophic event again, but I think the other Esper kids kind of convince him to knock it off. So it doesn't like finish this time. And so Neo Tokyo is still standing mostly, except for this kind of crater. And that's basically the end of the movie. We get another kind of weird, trippy sequence at the end with some kind of lights and stuff on the screen. And we hear a voice say, "I am Tetsuo," and then the movie just ends.
Yeah. Cause he's alive.
Yeah. So my understanding is he is birthing a new universe.
Yeah.
Like his essence is like birthing a new universe, basically. So happy ending for Tetsuo. It all worked out all right for him.
See, it was all fine.
Oh, man. I got to hand it to the guy. Let's see, the voice actor that played Tetsuo, his name, I wrote it here, Nozomu Sazaki. You know, I can't say a lot for the voice acting in general in this movie, but that particular dude, I think, did an incredible job with this character. Like all the anguish and stuff that he's going through, and especially like seeing his kind of journey, like when he first starts to realize he has these powers, and you know, while he's still in control a little bit, he does such a great job of like conveying this like slightly unhinged teenager, you know, that's like he has this kind of ability and he's not quite sure what he's going to do with it. Just becoming more and more and more unhinged as it goes. He does a great job. And all the scenes where he's just like straight up just screaming in agony, you know, just a great job. I mean, some really good screaming. I really felt sorry for the kid.
I mean, that's
really
half of the time he's in pain. He's like suffering. I mean, even when he's like, you know, it's like every couple minutes he has to double over and just be like, because he's just, he's, you know, there's so much going on. And it's probably physical and mental anguish.
But the animation conveys that really well too, just how he's like writhing and stuff. But as far as just talk about some of the characters here. The main character, Kaneda. I know I referred to Tetsuo as Goku earlier, but really, Kaneda reminds me of Goku. Just that, I don't know if you've watched Dragon Ball Z, but Goku is hilarious because he's the hero of that show. He's the most powerful guy in the whole world, but he's a complete idiot at the same time. You know, he's just a total bonehead doofus. Kaneda kind of reminds me of that. He's the cool guy. He's the guy in charge. He's the main character, but he's kind of dumb, honestly. He's not a super bright guy, but you know, he's lovable though.
He's the gang leader. He's the pal that gets beat up the least. So he's the one that,
yeah,
he's the go-to guy that everyone follows. But it is cool that he doesn't change. You know, it's not like, and by the end of the movie, he realized what honor and no, he's the same dude.
No.
He like,
yeah, he's the same guy.
But there's so many epic scenes of him being, he has that like heroic, like he can be Indiana Jones when he needs to be, but he's never going to be that like suave, mature leader. But like the scenes where they go into that, whatever that thing is, when they're on the rescue mission and he sneaks in with that like resistance group and he steals the little floaty water bike thing from that guy and they're like zipping around and everybody's chasing him, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
He's just like totally awesome when he's Indiana Jones mode. But
you need a guy like that. When it's time to snap into action, you need a guy like that. You know, like kind of the recklessness is kind of a good thing in a way.
Yeah, very carefree, careless. And if you weren't that way, you would care too much and you would probably just die.
Yeah. You got to take risks sometimes.
Speaking of characters, I felt like the like military general dude, Zangief looking dude. Like my reaction to him in the beginning, he's like, oh, they're going to have to deal with this guy. But he actually seemed like he was trying to keep everything contained
He's kind of all right.
Yeah. He was kind of the voice of reason in a lot of the areas, especially when they were meeting with that board of, I don't know what they would even be, like the government board people.
Yeah. The secret board of lizard people that control the world.
I mean, he was the one that was trying to talk sense into them, not basically messing around with what's going on and taking it seriously. And then he would show up on the scene.
Basically, if they just let him be in charge of the whole thing from the beginning, that whole catastrophe probably could have been avoided.
And you think about, like, when he first busts up on the scene, you think, like, every scene he's going to be in, like, oh, man, now he's going to, you know, he's going to stop them from doing this or whatever. But he was really just acting as a caretaker of the situation that seemingly only him and that scientist dude understood the gravity of.
Yeah.
Props to Zangief.
Oh, he's awesome. I love, I call him government military guy. I can't remember his act. He has a name. I can't remember
what his name is.
He has a cool scene. There's a scene towards the end where they're like the government is like trying to relieve him of duty and take control of the situation. He's like, no. And he's like, I'm in charge now. And like, his guys are all backing him up. And he's like, you guys are silly. Go away.
Yeah. That's funny. Which, you know, that's just a testament to his ability to lead. No one questioned him.
Yeah.
Even when the actual people over him tried to take control, he was like, didn't he just be like, shoot him? I think he said that.
Yeah.
He's like, shoot him.
He said, I can't remember the exact words, but basically like, shoot him. Okay, stop. And then continued his conversation. Yeah. Pretty funny. So yeah, notable scenes that I just wanted to mention. Of course, there's the opening scene with the biker gang fight with the clowns and all that stuff. We get the famous like skid shot that everyone knows where not Akira, but Kaneda is doing a little skid on his big red motorcycle. We talked all about that earlier, but that really is what I thought the whole movie was going to be, but it's really just kind of like the first 10 minutes. Oh, a scene that I wanted to mention for it's just sort of illustrating the brutality of the world here. After Tetsuo steals Kaneda's motorcycle early on, and then the clowns catch up to him and are messing with him. And then Kaori, Tetsuo's girlfriend gets her shirt ripped off, and then the dude punches her right in the face.
Yeah, that was.
And then nobody gives a crap.
That was very. That was the thing that made me real, kind of what I was talking about earlier about how the kids are just a product of the that world. That was the scene that made me think of that. Yeah. I'm like, man, they're like, you know, nothing crazy happened. They didn't like take advantage of her or anything. They were just being violent because that's how that world is. And yeah, they busted her. I mean, not only did they rip her shirt off, but I mean, she is like swole up. I mean, she looks like she just got like in a fight with Conor McGregor, you know?
I mean, she looks like she's a 14-year-old girl. Yeah. She had her freaking top ripped off and punched in the face unconscious. She's like all bloody and stuff. And then like they just kind of threw a jacket over her. No one's asking her if she's okay. No one's even talking to her. They're just over here like what are we going to do now, guys? You know,
let's get out of here.
and she's like doesn't even know where she is right now. She just like dragged herself off the freaking concrete.
It's like not funny, but that yeah. That's yeah. It's true. I mean, that's that scene yeah. really was like, oh, okay, this is how that is here. Okay.
Yeah, like they don't give a crap. They're like, oh, here's a jacket. Anyway, moving on. Let's see here. Yeah, we already talked about Tetsuo's hallucination sequence in the testing facility. Just freaking psychotic stuff. Some amazing animation. Just like technically impressive stuff. And it's really cool. I would say don't watch that on if you're like on mushrooms or something like that. Probably not going to be a good time.
you will be Tetsuo.
Yeah. When Tetsuo like rips off like some piece of fabric and puts a cape on, it's really the first time that anyone looks anything like an anime character in this old movie.
Yeah.
I thought that was just kind of funny. It's like the first like real like actual anime looking dude.
That was interesting. That he did that because that made just what I gathered from that is that was him. That was the peak of his not understanding the gravity as a young yeah. kid would. He's like, you know what? I'm freaking Superman now. And I'm about Superman. To freaking throw yeah. down, you know, like, and him throwing on a cape, which is, you know, such a childish thing to do.
Yeah.
But like, that's he is a child. I thought that was a pretty, yeah, that was yeah, pretty I mean, poignant. Obviously it was funny, you know, and could be easily, it wasn't like a major plot point or anything, but I thought that was a clever little add in.
That's a great detail.
Yeah.
That was a great, it's exactly what, yeah, it's, they nailed that character and like they picked the perfect kind of character, like the sort of downtrodden younger brother type. He's not actually a younger brother, but he's like that, you know? It's like, yeah, he would act like that. He totally would. Like, it just makes sense. The scene where they like shoot the giant space laser down at him to try and take him out was pretty cool. You remember, because after they're done blasting him and there's all this like gigantic debris and stuff falling and Kaneda's like basically almost dies like 10 times in a row as he's trying to like get away from just various stuff falling on him. This show does, or this movie does a great job of moments like that, like conveying the sense of scale. Like these people are ants amidst all this like massive stuff happening, you know, like there's a scene where like a bridge collapses and stuff and you just see people just getting crushed underneath it all.
Yeah.
Cool moments like that. Horrifying moments like that.
You see the real,
convey that stuff really well.
You see the real consequences of that type of thing happening, you know, and that's, yeah. You know, in kind of like sci-fi and stuff, movies like that, it was kind of ignored for a long time. I remember they started putting that element in like comics and there were some major storylines where it's like, dude, we're having all these battles just around regular people. You know, we're X-Men are flying in and battling Magneto in the middle of, you know, a city where people are like getting ice cream. And stuff, you know, like things, people are going to be yeah, injured. Like it's, there's consequences for this type of behavior. And there was a whole storyline around that. But I liked that they did that in this movie. They at least showed, not that I wanted to see people getting, you know, plowed and dying and stuff, but it's, you know, there's a massive amount of things going on. And because
yeah,
of
it also
that,
shows like the indifference. Like the indifference of the government officials doing these things, yeah. You know, like they know those people are there, you know, and they're doing it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at the scale that this stuff is happening too, like, you know, you call it debris, like you think of debris, it's like, oh, small little things flying around, but no, like from the space laser, the debris is like the size of a building.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. It's debris stuff that can take out a city block easily.
Yeah. That was just cool watching Kaneda try to escape from that situation. Like, yeah, that kind of is what that would be. Like, you see his tiny little ant-sized body running away from all this giant stuff.
Yeah.
And we already talked all about Tetsuo's grotesque transformation, his weird, like, his arm gets blasted off at some point, and he, like, makes himself a new arm out of just, like, random scrap metal and stuff. It kind of looks like a robot arm. But then as he starts to lose control, like, that robot arm starts to go haywire, and it starts, like, grabbing onto things in random ways. It, like, looks creepy and unsettling.
Yeah, I mean, that was just another element of the power that he just was not in control of.
Yeah. But, yeah, we already talked all about that crazy transformation and all that stuff, but that's just another scene I wanted to mention. Any other scenes that stood out to you that I didn't mention?
I mean, I think those were the main ones.
Yeah.
I thought the scenes where, I forget the little scientist dude's name, where the guy that monitors the level of, I don't know if it's the level of Akira with that little...
They called it an aura.
Yeah, the aura. Like, that was pretty interesting. I don't know if they really expanded on that a lot. It was just kind of like an understood type of thing. But I thought that was cool that they had at least someone in the movie that, which is kind of why that military guy always knew how extreme the situation was or the seriousness of it. I liked that they had that in there, because with all that stuff going on, as massive as it was and fantastical and like absolute power beyond the scale anyone could comprehend, it was cool that there were some people who are like, man, it's getting worse. That kind of amplified like the seriousness of the situation. Like, man, it's about to be like, things are about to go down.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's about it. I think we covered everything else.
funclubpod@gmail.com. That is our email address. If you'd like to send us an email, we strongly encourage it. You can ask us any questions. You can make suggestions for the show, add to conversations that we've had in the past, you know, fill us in on details and stuff that we've missed. I know we've missed most of them, probably.
Most likely.
We have received our first email to the podcast. It's an exciting time. We actually got it a while back. I haven't been checking the email because I just assume no one's been emailing us. This is a brand new show, but we did get an email back in February 19th from Spring Armsman.
Oh, well, Spring Armsman.
Spring Armsman says, "How dare you mewling weaklings invoke my name for your new show without contacting my agent first? A henchman of my sheer savage springiness cannot be bothered with such trifling mortal matters as booking fees or residuals. Due to my coily blessing, it is quite difficult to use your human interface devices to communicate. Therefore, I look forward to meeting you on the battlefield you call podcast. S.A.M. Spring Arms Man. P.S. No personal checks."
His coily blessing. That's a good description. That was from episode one. So this person, Spring Arms Man, it's nice that he's been along from the beginning.
Grizzly Khan denies that it's him. And Spring Arms Man spells the word Sam, so I thought it was maybe my friend Sam, but he denies it as well. So maybe it's real.
I mean, it is possible that, you know, a lot of people believe in manifestation. And it is possible that we manifested him, but unlikely since he's upset at the residuals issue.
Well, thanks for writing in, Spring Armsman. Nice to hear from you. funclubpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And I think that's the end of this. No, we're not quite done. We got to, what are we watching next time, Crow? Or what are we doing next time? You got to pick your
Yes. Scene. So it might be a little out of left field, but I thought it would be fun to do.
Okay.
Love, Death, and Robots Season 1.
Oh, dude, I'm into it. I love it.
Yeah, so I don't know. Have you seen that yet?
I have. I will happily watch it a second time.
Yeah, I've seen it too. love to go back. And even though it's a season, you know, the episodes are like 10 minutes long, something like that. So easily.
Yeah.
I thought it'd be interesting to do something that had a lot of content that didn't have anything really to do with each other. You know, it's just a bunch of little short form kind of shorts that would be easy to,
yeah,
fun
I like
to talk
that.
About.
We can just talk about, yeah, we can just kind of talk about each one by one and just kind of go along.
Yeah. So that is my pick.
Awesome. Love, Death, and Robots season one, which is on Netflix.
Yes, it is on Netflix. I think it's is that a Netflix original? I think it is.
I want to say it is. Yeah. Sweet. I'm excited.
As am I.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode, episode number 5. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Sorry if I butchered the pronunciation.
And they were like, "Oh."